We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this hour, a conversation that has to do with energy, and certainly it's a subject that we have talked about before on this program with many different guests, but not often with somebody who brings the perspective of a very large energy company. That's what this interview does. A conversation with Mike Loudon. He's a geophysicist. He works with ExxonMobil. He was visiting the campus of the University of Illinois last week, and we were scheduled to have him on the program in a live interview. Take calls, as we usually do. That morning, the White House announced that the president would be having a news conference, and we decided we wanted to take that and broadcast that live. So what we did was sit down in the studio with Mike Loudon and record the interview, and that is what you'll hear. Unfortunately, that means that in this first hour of the program, we will not be able to take calls. Well, this morning in this hour of focus, we will be talking about a number of things. We'll try to have an assessment of what the global demand for energy is these days, and also talk with a senior scientist from ExxonMobil about how that need might be met. And our guest for the program is a geophysicist, Mike Loudon. He has worked now for ExxonMobil for a number of years. He joined the company when it was just Mobil after he graduated from Penn State. His academic training is in geology and geophysics. He's done a number of things. He worked as resources manager for the company with responsibility for worldwide geophysical operations and also career development. And he has, in his job, spent some of his time traveling around and going to college campuses and looking for people who might want to go to work for the company. Just more recently, he's been involved in developing ExxonMobil's U.S. campus project, a place where they bring together their scientists to do their work. And we'll talk about a number of things. We'll try to talk about the world energy supply. We'll talk about efforts to expand the supply, both from existing resources, oil, gas, and also renewables. We'll try also to talk about how we meet that challenge and at the same time reduce emissions that have impact on the climate. We're recording the program, so that means that we will not be able to take calls. We hope that in any case that you'll find what he has to say interesting. I do want to mention that he's here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois, and his visit is sponsored by the Prairie Research Institute, which is the home of the state scientific surveys here on the campus of University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. That's the Natural History Survey, the State Archaeological Survey, the State Geological Survey, the State Water Survey, and also the Illinois Sustainable Technology Center. So we want to say thanks to them for making it possible for us to talk with the guest. Hey, thank you very much for being here.
Oh, thank you for the opportunity. We really appreciate it.
We appreciate it as well. I don't want to get people snowed down in numbers right to start, but I do want to talk about world energy consumption, you know, what the demand for energy is, and then perhaps we can go on and talk about how we think that demand's going to grow. Is it possible in a way that people who are not scientists can understand that you can say something about how much energy is being used now today?
That's a really great lead-off question, David. Thanks. I guess the way I'd like to approach that is to say in the last 30 minutes of people's lives, whatever they've been doing, there's been enough steel produced in the world to build 11 Eiffel Towers. That is just one economic activity, but it gives you some idea that to produce steel takes an enormous amount of energy. I guess another good way to look at it is that, you know, people look at ExxonMobil, the company I work for. It's the biggest non-government-owned corporation in the world. And yet we are only account for 2% of the production of the world's energy. So there's in essence 50 other ExxonMobil's worth of supply out there besides what we produce. So it's an absolutely enormous undertaking.
Mm-hmm. One thing that I did was try to look at some numbers about what the projections for demand were thought to be in the coming decades. And I'm sure that you ask different people, you're going to get different numbers. But one thing that I was looking at was some numbers from essentially from the U.S. Department of Energy, from their statistical arm. What they're predicting is that between 2008 and 2035, that world energy consumption will grow by a little over 50%, so half again as much as we're using now. And it seems that, you know, different people have different numbers, but, you know, I think there are people who are saying that they expect, you know, over the next 20 years, it could maybe only 30%, but it seems to me a lot of people seem to settle around the 50% number, which when you think about it is pretty stunning, that we're going to need to come up with half again as much energy as we're producing now to meet this projected demand. Is that, how do you feel about numbers like that?
Well, that's very much in line with the sort of numbers that we have in our energy outlook. And actually, before I go any further, if any of the listeners would like to, they can go to our website and pull up the energy outlook that we publish, and it's available on our website. And you could actually, as we're chatting during this hour, take a look at some of the things that are in that. Mm-hmm. But in that energy outlook, which we develop every year, we are projecting by the year 2030, so about 20 years from now, we'll be at about 35% more energy consumption in the world than what we have today.
So it, you know, that maybe we're arguing that's a small thing, really, when you're talking about that much additional energy needed. So 30%, so 50%, that's still a remarkable number when you think about how big energy demand is now and then what we expected it's going to be. So then the question is, well, how does that energy demand, how will that be met?
Well, in a lot of ways, and I guess if you don't mind, I'll take us a little bit trip down history.
Sure.
If you go, I'm actually going to go back to before there was any fossil fuels. So all the way up until really the early 1800s, the energy source for the world was wood. So we have a fancy name for that now. It's biomass. Mm-hmm. In the early 1800s, coal kicked in. And it took coal about 4 or 5 decades to reach a point where it actually accounted for about half of the world's energy consumption. But it had a great advantage. It had a great energy intensity compared to the wood. So you could say you're on a ship, you could put a lot of coal on the ship and go a lot further than if you put that equivalent amount of wood on the ship. So it was a huge advantage to be able to burn coal. And you know, you've heard the expression King Coal. Well, it really was king for a really long time. And it's still a very significant source of the world's energy usage today. And we think that in the next 10 or 20 years, it'll decrease some, but still be a very important part of the world's energy mix. So the next big thing that happened in the energy world was the introduction of oil, and that happened in the late 1800s. And you know, it's hard for people to imagine, but you know, when oil was first introduced, it was a bit of a niche product. Its killer app was actually illuminance. So people used kerosene to provide light at nighttime in their lives, and this actually displaced whale oil as the equivalent sort of application product. So at any rate, then along came the invention of the internal combustion engine, early 1900s, development of mass production, and so on and so forth. But it really took oil until really about the 1940s, 1950s, before it really became a sort of a share of the world's energy usage that actually we are familiar with today. So, you know, start 1870, go to 1940, 1950. It takes a long time to actually change the world's energy mix. The next thing to happen was natural gas. It was really a byproduct of the oil for a long time. People discovered they could do street lights, so that you see the gas lights out there. That's where it all started. Mm-hmm. People used to light the streets at night. And then people discovered, after a long time, really, that its killer app was actually power generation. And so that has grown a lot. And we see the power generation, and we can talk more about that as we go on, but power generation being a huge driver for energy demand around the world over the next couple of decades. So we see gas, by the time we reach 2030, supplying something on the order of 25 or 30% of the world's mix. So far, we're seeing, there's still biomass being used in the world today. We're still using coal. That'll also still be true in 2030 in our outlook. Oil, natural gas. But there's some other things that have, some non-carbon-based things that have been showing up, and we need to talk about those. So starting in the late 1800s, again, people discovered, if you build a dam, you can produce electricity. And so we started to have hydroelectric power. But at the end of the day, there's a limit on how many dams you can build, how many streams you can divert, et cetera, et cetera. And, of course, these all have environmental consequences as well, as we all know. And so at the end of the day, you're at about stuck at maybe 2 or 3% of supply for the world. And it's great supply. It's clean, no hydrocarbon emissions. But at the end of the day, you can't really grow it very significantly. Another thing that started happening in the 1960s was the construction of nuclear power plants. And the locus of that development was primarily North America and Europe, and some in the former Soviet Union as well. And the construction of those plants has slowed down, and now the construction, it tends to be in Asia, so India, China, some in Japan. But at any rate, we anticipate that the nuclear power generation will continue to grow, but it's still not, in terms of the overall mix, it's not a very big part worldwide. And then we get to some of the renewable energies that, and it's hard for people really to imagine this, but before 2004, 2005, these almost didn't exist. That sort of demand really wasn't even there. And so if you look at the numbers that will show up in our energy outlook, it's this explosion, 2004, 2005, tremendous growth rates, both for wind, for solar, for biofuels. And we expect actually that sector of the energy business to grow the fastest over the next decades. In fact, say about on the order of 10% per year versus natural gas at about 2% per year. The problem is that they start at a very, very low basis, essentially almost zero in the year 2004, 2005. And so you grow a very, very small number by 10% per year. It grows really quickly, but it takes a long time to really become a major contributor to the world's energy mix. And so just as it took oil decades and decades and decades to really get to the position it is now, we think the same thing is going to happen with some of these newer fuel alternatives.
Yeah. Just for anybody who might have tuned in, I want to introduce again our guest, Mike Loudon. He's a geophysicist. He works for the ExxonMobil company and has done a number of things. He's been with the company ever since 1979 and has worked in a number of capacities, and he had at one point responsibility for all the geophysical operations around the world, was also very much involved in career development for their scientists, has spent time on college campuses looking for people who might want to go to work for ExxonMobil, and has more recently been involved in their U.S. campus project, and that is ExxonMobil's campus, where they have their scientists all together. And he's visiting the campus, was here to give a talk. We're recording this interview, so that means that in this hour of the show, we won't be taking calls. Here, the bottom line here, and this is something that I think, perhaps some people will not be happy to hear, particularly people who have heard some of the very optimistic projections for the possibility for renewables. And I mentioned a little earlier that I had been looking at some figures coming out of the Department of Energy, what they think is going to be happening for the future. And in their projections, essentially, it's the same thing that you're saying here, is that what they're expecting is that, say, again, over the next 20 years, the largest source of energy will continue to be fossil fuels. And primarily that, and the big one there is going to be liquid fuels that are petroleum-based, the things that we use to power transportation. And in addition, there will be some places where coal, particularly in India and China, is going to be the big source of energy. So what we have here is, and that's going to, people are going to say, well, we have this problem with fossil fuels, and we're going to continue to have this problem if we rely that heavily on them. But it doesn't really, while there are these other alternatives, it doesn't seem that any of them rise to the level of being able to meet energy demand the way that essentially these kinds of things that are petroleum products do.
Right.
Which I suppose this is good for ExxonMobil, but I think a lot of people will find that discouraging. And they may not even want to believe it because it's coming from a guy from ExxonMobil.
Well, as you say, we're not the only ones that have these opinions or outlooks at what's going to be happening in the future. But I think, and I sympathize with people. We're used to change happening pretty quickly in this, especially in this country. But if you step back and look at really kind of the bigger picture, energy usage is global. You can ship coal, you can ship oil. There's a lot of this stuff that's very fungible. And so it's really a global market. And if you look at what's happening in the world, not just in the United States, because there's a big difference, we're seeing uncounted millions of people rising up out of poverty in Asia in particular. And this, as that happens, they are going to want the exact same things that we have enjoyed here in the United States and other parts of the developed world. For many decades. So things like lights, things like sockets in the walls you can plug in for electricity. There's currently about 1.4 billion people in the world who don't have access to any electricity. So there's this enormous amount of potential growth, which is actually going on. And in many ways, that's really, really, really good news for so many people in the world that they can have a warm place to sleep, and they can be dry, and they can have light at night, and they can be educated, and they can have clean water supplies. So there's a lot of good there that's going on. But the fact is that while the developed countries as a group, we see energy levels really kind of peaking out and being on a very long, slow decline in terms of overall energy usage, that's absolutely not the case in the other parts of the world. People are really using more and more and more and more energy as their countries develop. So that's one big thing that's going on. The other big thing that is going on, or second of the three, is that having said all this, we really need to use our energy resources of all sorts much more efficiently than we have. Mm-hmm. Because that's really what's going to be required to enable the world to grow and yet not have to develop even more new sources of energy over the next decades than the 35% growth that we're quoting. Yeah. So without that kind of conservation and efficiency effort, what you're going to end up with is something on the order of 75, 80, 90% more energy needed just to keep up with all the economic growth that's going on in the world. Mm-hmm. So conservation and efficiency gains is actually a huge topic. So that's the number two thing. The number three thing is, we have very high levels of CO2 in the atmosphere right now, and that poses risks. Both to ecosystems and societies, and so they need to be managed. So unfortunately, it's not a question of we want one of these three things or two of these three things. What people really need to have is all of these things: growth, conservation, and managing emissions. And it's a very tough thing to do, but that's really the challenge.
Well, what is the official position of ExxonMobil on global climate change, whether in fact it's happening, and whether it is the result of human activity?
Well, basically, I gave you part of the answer already. So with the high emissions that we have pose risks, and so they do need to be managed. They need to be managed basically by governments, by companies, and by individuals, you and me, in our daily activities. And so to help us to do that, we actually are part of the discussions with governments on policies. And so we, when we go out and talk to governments, we say, well, look, the first thing to say is energy is a really big part of economic growth. So be careful You know, we have to be very vigilant that we don't really hurt economic growth in the name of reducing emissions and then cause other problems that are just as bad. So what we have to be careful with that. Number two, we have to have policies that are very low cost to society. So low administrative costs. Number three, these policies should not be specific to one part of the economy. So we know CO2 emissions, they can come from shipping, they can come from automobiles, they can come from the agricultural sector, they can come from the steelmaking sector. So, you know, whatever the policy is really needs to cover all of those sectors. And then the other piece of it is, unless we really attack this thing globally, it's not going to matter too much anyway, because at the end of the day, the CO2 molecules really don't care if they come from China or India or the United States or Canada. So, you know, that's when we talk to governments, that's what we say. And then we're doing, within our own company, we're doing an awful lot just to practice what we preach on this. And so we have a number of initiatives going on. One is the Global Energy Management System. And this is all the way from being more efficient at our refineries, which are very high energy intensive activities, as you might imagine, all the way down to changing the light bulbs in my office last year because they were burning too much electricity for the amount of light given. So, you know, common sense things. Yeah. And then, you know, over onto, you know, personal, you know, sort of personal activities. We have an ability to recycle ourselves. We have an ability to carpool. We have an ability to do put insulation in our houses. So there's an awful lot of that people can do at all levels. Yeah.
Well, forgive me, but I just have to ask this because there has been a lot of criticism of your company for funding research of global warming skeptics to the tune of millions of dollars a year. And there are some people who say, well, it's the intent of the company to do that and to try to create doubt in the minds of the public as to whether or not global warming is a problem, that it's the result of burning fossil fuels. I'm sure you're used to this kind of criticism. There are people who say, well, that the company has not exactly been taking the kind of approach that you just here have described.
Well, I think if you go and look at where this is coming from, it's probably in a period several years ago. And what we found was that while we were funding various organizations that were doing a lot of things, and they may have been doing part of that with respect to the sorts of activities that you're talking about, that was not the intent. In the event, we've stopped funding the companies, the organizations, mm-hmm. just to make sure that our position is clear. So we are not doing that anymore.
All right. Let me ask you, go back to the subject of demand and demand for oil, because, as I said, it certainly seems that petroleum products, gas and oil, are going to continue to be the major source of energy, and demand, we expect demand for those things is going to grow. And at the same time, now for a number of years, there have been people raising questions about how much oil there is out there in the world yet to get, and whether we are at, close to, past peak production around the world. And they say, you know, we've gotten the easy oil. There may still be more oil there, which you could get, but it's going to be more expensive. The environmental issues are going to be bigger. What's your feeling about this issue of how much oil yet there is out there in the world to be recovered? And in fact, you know, to put the qualification on there, to be recovered in an economically feasible way.
Right. Well, great question. And I think the way I like to look at it is you go back to the year 1980 and you look at how much oil the United States Geological Survey, who is one of its charges is to make these global resource assessments. They had at that time about 1.5 trillion barrels of oil as the Earth's total endowment that would be economic to recover. By the year 2000, that had grown to nearly four trillion barrels. So, you know, it wasn't a matter that these guys at the USGS weren't doing their job very well. What was really going on over that 20-year period was that technology was changing what was economic. Mm-hmm. And so part of that was finding out, well, you know, gosh, we can find major oil and gas deposits way offshore of continental shelves, which when I joined the industry, nobody believed could even happen. Everybody knew you couldn't do it, but here we are today, and we are doing it in 10,000 feet of water and these sorts of environments. So it's really an amazing thing. So where you can find oil has changed. Beyond that, what in terms of the fields we've already discovered, we've, again, sort of used our human ingenuity to figure out ways to get more out of the fields we've already discovered. So between sort of expanding the amount of oil that is even there in our mines because we didn't even think we could find it in some of these places, and then being able to get more out of what we've already found, we've basically changed the size of the container. And that hasn't stopped. I said this was going on over a 20-year period. Beyond that, we're now seeing development in oil shales. People talk about shale gas, but there's also shale oil that is sort of on the horizon. So the bottom line here is that the size of the container has not stayed the same at all. And so for people to say, well, we're going to run out of economic oil, you have to kind of know, or you have to in some ways make an assumption that we won't keep making technological advances. And that's never really been true.
Well, what's daily oil production now in terms of barrels?
I haven't looked recently, but it's in the mid 80 million barrels a day.
Yeah. And now, again, I don't know how you feel about these numbers, but again, going back to the DOE and their projections, they apparently say that to meet the demand, world oil production is going to have to grow by something like 26 million barrels a day over the next 20 years. Is such a thing possible?
Yeah, we think it is. And by the way, that demand, you know, again, I mentioned that in the developed countries, the demand of oil is actually on a slow decline. So the demand, yeah, is extra demand is coming from these developed countries, say China, where you're going to over this period get something on the order of 400 million new automobiles. It's a staggering thought, but in places like the U.S., we're not going to see much of a fleet growth. So yeah, that's where this demand is coming from. But in terms of meeting that demand, we think it's possible. You know, we already build just ExxonMobil, six or seven offshore structures the size of the football stadium here at University of Illinois every year. And, you know, of enormous complexity, obviously, to do the kind of job that we do. So, yes, it's going to take an enormous amount of investment over the next decades to make this happen. But we certainly see that the resources are there.
Yeah. Our guest in this part of Focus is Michael Loudon. He is a geophysicist. He works with ExxonMobil Company. He had his academic training in geology and geophysics, and went to work for Mobil when it was Mobil, when he graduated from Penn State. And has been with the company ever since. The merger occurred in, was it 2000, became Exxon?
Yeah, late 1999, right.
He's done a number of things for the company. He's been involved, for example, in worldwide geoscience recruiting and career development, and has been now for some time been involved in their U.S. campus project, geoscience coordinator for the U.S. campus project, which is, maybe you could say something about that. What we're talking about here is ExxonMobil's campus. It's your place where you have your scientists all together working.
Yeah, that's right. Currently in Houston, and you know, Houston is the big sort of center for ExxonMobil and most of the U.S. energy companies, for that matter. But we have offices spread all across the city right now, which has just sort of evolved over the last decades. And so our chairman, Rex Tillerson, was looking to really help us to, you know, consolidate into a campus environment. So Yes, they're going to be office buildings, but they're going to be low-rise, and it's going to be just an absolutely wonderful place for our people to work. And the hope is, certainly, that by putting the geoscientists and the engineers and the land people and the drilling people and the law people and all the groups together in one place, that we'll have a lot of synergies that we don't enjoy today.
Yeah, okay. Also, maybe I should mention for the benefit of people listening that we are recording this interview. He's here visiting the campus. His visit sponsored by the Prairie Research Institute, which is the home of all the state scientific surveys. You're at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. He's here visiting. And so that means in this hour of the show, we're not taking calls. Is the company interested in other sources of energy that are not oil and gas?
Well, two things on that. We, Exxon and the Heritage Mobil, independently in the 1980s, had big efforts going on in solar power, and so the photovoltaic cells. At the end of the day, the physics defeated us. We were not able to, despite the billions and billions and billions that both companies invested, get the solar panels to a point where they could be an economically attractive alternative to some of the other energy sources. And so both companies just sort of bit the bullet and stopped that research because it just wasn't – we weren't able to make it work. I think things are further along today, but my understanding is that the physics, you know, still present almost insuperable problems. In terms of one of the things that we are doing right now, though, is we are sponsoring a very large research effort in the area of algae fuels or fuels from algae. Mm-hmm. So we really hope that this works because if it does, it'll be ideal in many ways. So you grow the algae and it takes CO2 out of the atmosphere. And then if you make the fuels from them and introduce them to basically to conventional equipment that we use today for transportation, you re-release the CO2. But then again, the cycle goes on. You pull it back in, grow more algae. So it's a zero-sum picture with respect to emissions. So that's a big plus. Another big plus is that it takes up very little land area compared to some of the other biofuel ideas that are out there. And as we all know, algae, if you have it in your swimming pools all the time and you see it in these disgusting places, the bottom line is it really doesn't care so much about the water quality. And mm-hmm. so it's not a competitor for a lot of the fresh water supplies. And you don't need arable farmland to grow it. You could, for that matter, you could in principle, grow it anywhere where there's a lot of sunlight. Mm-hmm. So we have committed up to $600 million to this effort, so it's a lot of money. So far, the research milestones have been met. We're very pleased with that. And significantly, we're partnered with Craig Venter's company, Synthetic Genomics. We have a very very good partner in this endeavor, and so we're keeping our fingers crossed. Mm.
Well, you know, given that the demand for liquid transportation fuels is so big, I would think that for this really to make much to make it make sense economically, but particularly to make it make sense if what you're trying to do is lessen our dependence on petroleum, the scale of production would have to be enormous. How much algae would you have to really make a dent in how much oil we use?
Well, we don't see it as being I think you actually put it right. To make a dent in it, we're not trying to say that this is going to replace the whole petroleum systems that we know today. In fact, we'd say because of the growth in energy demand over the next several decades, that we're really going to need all of the economic or economically competitive fuel sources that there are out there. Mm-hmm. And so this would just give us another option. But again, depending on how well things go, it's very attractive because, there's a lot of desert area you're not really going to be competing on the land front use or land usage front, pardon me. You're not going to be competing so much on the waterfront. Mm-hmm. So there's huge pluses on this, and it keeps you out of the whole argument of food versus fuel as well.
So that you'd be talking about essentially building big land-based algae farms, where I guess you would need to have some kind of pool, but it wouldn't have to be very deep, just enough water to have your algae grow on, and theoretically that could be as big as you would have space to make it.
Yeah, it's all in its early days. This is something that even if it's successful, and there's no guarantee that it will be, it's going to be many years before it really grows to the point of making a big dent, as you say. Yeah. Just as when any of these new energy sources, it takes a long time for them to really make their presence felt.
Well, are there people in the company who say, we're an oil company. We've always been an oil company. What are we doing messing around with algae?
No, not really, because, in essence, the fuels that you'd be getting from algae would require still some refining, although much less than the petroleum. And so it really uses existing infrastructure that we already have. So our refineries, at the end of the day, the filling stations would still be the filling stations. So it has another big plus, which is the infrastructure is already built.
I'm going back to the idea that as much concern as there is about burning fossil fuel and oil particularly, and as much interest as there is in developing alternatives, the economy runs on oil. And you talked about the fact that the Industrial Revolution was really made possible by coal. And then economic booms since then have really been driven by oil. People continue to ask what the next thing is, but it seems that we're still very dependent on oil, and we're going to be for the foreseeable future, at least 20 years, and probably longer than that, which means one of the things it means, I suppose, is ExxonMobil, it's not going away anytime soon. That, as much as the energy mix might change some, that maybe 50 years from now, do you really think 50 years from now it's going to look that different from what it looks like today?
Well, I think, just as we continue to use biomass that humanity's always used today, mm-hmm. It's almost 10% of what the energy the world uses today is from biomass. Just as coal hasn't really gone away, it's gotten smaller. But then recently it's gotten bigger as the Asian growth has continued. We're going to see a lot of the same players out there 50 years from now. I think the difference is going to be that some of the alternatives that are being worked on today will have actually made it and proven that they're economically viable. Now, what those are, hard to say. But at the same time, back to my earlier remarks, never count out human ingenuity.
Yeah. How do you respond to the people who make the criticism and say that the problem for alternatives is that it is not a level playing field, and that big companies like yours have tremendous advantages? First of all, you have an advantage of scale just because you're so big. And then there are all sorts of subsidies and benefits that fossil fuel industry receives that the alternatives like solar and wind and geothermal just don't have. And that the reason that they're not economically viable now is that they're fighting an uphill battle against big companies like yours that have many advantages that they don't have.
Well, I wouldn't dispute that we have some advantages, scale certainly being one of them, but I would say in terms of subsidies, it's quite the opposite of what you're saying. So there's been a lot of talk recently that, from Washington about the whole, the oil companies have these subsidies and they need to be clawed back and so on and so forth. Well, there's one in particular that could talk about the Section 199 plan that was put into place basically to protect U.S. manufacturing jobs. Well, that's what they're talking about. But it's hard for me to see how an oil company job is different than another sort of manufacturing job, say a computer manufacturing job. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, the intent of that legislation was not to favor one sector over another. But those are the sorts of things that are being talked about. And so I think there's a certain amount of labeling issues on all of this that we hear about. On the flip side, in fact, there are enormous subsidies out there for wind power. I've just read an article in the USA Today this morning, 6th of October, that talked about a lot of subsidies that have gone to geothermal companies that have now find themselves just in terrible financial condition. But it's not because they haven't had subsidies. In fact, they've had enormous subsidies. So I guess I just don't agree with that premise.
Is it, you know, the problems that renewables face, are they basically technological problems? That is just, finding the way to make the right device to solve the scientific problems, and that the big thing is that's still a work in progress?
Well, I think it really depends on what the alternative fuel is. So in the case of the algae, there's enormous hurdles that still remain in terms of making that a viable alternative, even though we've been successful with our milestones to date. A lot of these research efforts around wasn't built in the day. If you're looking at solar, yeah, you bet there's big breakthroughs needed. There's still the efficiency of the photovoltaic panels to be able to convert the photons from the sun into electricity has to be higher than what it is today to be really something that's going to make a difference. And even then, you have problems with land usage because the things are pretty big. Beyond that, you go to wind power and even though, along with solar, we see enormous growth in these sectors over the next decades, at the end of the day, not every place has wind, and places that do, it's not always there during the day. So, as I said, they each have their own set of challenges. And again, this is why, we don't see the entire energy supply system as an either-or proposition. We see it very much as a both-and proposition. We see that all of these various energy forms can have their place, certainly in the overall picture. But, they do have to be economically viable at the end of the day.
Yeah. Well, I suppose, one of the advantages that fossil fuels have is that the energy is stored in that fuel in a way that it sits there until you're ready to use it. They are, relatively speaking, easily transportable. We have an infrastructure to do that because that's what we've been doing now for such a long time, and that the renewables don't have those things. And one of the big things that people keep pointing to is, solar cells great as long as the sun's shining. But, what do you do? Is there some way for you to store excess energy that you're not going to use right then so that you can use it later when it's dark? And that still seems to be that still seems to be an issue.
Yeah, that's another way of saying you still need to need to build base load, whether that's in many cases, especially in Asia, they're building coal-powered plants or gas-powered plants or, for that matter, nuclear power plants.
Yeah. We're talking this morning in this hour focus with Mike Loudon. He's a geophysicist with ExxonMobil Company. He's here visiting the campus. His visit sponsored by the folks at the Prairie Research Institute. That's the home of the state scientific surveys. We're not taking calls this morning. We're recording this interview. We're sorry we can't give folks an access to him the way we usually would like to, but we're glad to have him here and have the chance to talk. How do you, it must be difficult for you working for a company that a lot of people hate, when you show up, I'm sure that people want to start throwing stuff, even if we're talking about metaphorically. And how do you feel about being in the position of I'm sure being frequently challenged about the company and its policies and its whole reason for being, what it actually does, start to finish?
Well, I have to say that I'm actually really proud of being a part of ExxonMobil. We do an enormous amount of good for an enormous amount of people, whether it's our communities, our shareholders, our employees. We do all sorts of fantastic things, all the way from supplying reliable and affordable sources of energy that make people's lives better and richer. And in the case of particularly over in Asia, bringing people up out of poverty by the millions, that's a terrific enterprise. So, I don't feel bad. And in fact, I welcome the ability to meet face to face with people because they, you know, certainly you're not going to change some people's minds, I guess. But, you know, when they see an actual human being standing there and they actually have a, you know, you start to tell a sort of a broader story than necessarily the one that they're used to hearing, you can get into some very good and very fruitful conversations with them. So, no, I welcome the opportunities to do it.
What would I'm just curious because I think that some people would say, and maybe this goes back to the question, and it's maybe still is a question about how much oil that there is, but they would sort of make an argument that says, well, oil is a very, in its raw form, it's a very special and valuable thing. You can do all kinds of stuff with it. And that given that, it doesn't make sense to burn it up. That what you really should be doing is refining it, doing all, you know, making all, you can make all kinds of stuff out of it. But the idea that you put it in the tank of a vehicle and burn it up in an internal combustion engine makes no sense at all.
Well, again, I think it gets back to an assumption that some people make that, you know, you've only got the container of oil that you got. And yeah, we keep showing time after time. Goodness, people were predicting the end of oil back in the 1920s. We've proven time and time again that, you know, there's a lot of that resource out there. So I don't worry about that so much. You know, we certainly use a lot of it for plastics manufacture, et cetera. And I guess the other thing to say is that not all crude oils are created equal. Some are better for producing fuels. Some of them are better for producing plastics. So, you know, there's a supply element to this as well.
Yeah. Well, when does the end really come? I mean, has someone I'm sure that's the kind of thing that people, you know, who do what you do think about. I'm sure people suspect they're in, you know, in some locked room there at ExxonMobil. You've got a big book that says, here, there's the day. I can point it to you. That's the day when it comes. Well, I'm sure that is not the case. But when does the end come? I mean, do you really have in your mind really some idea that, yeah, it may be decades, but the end is going to come?
Well, we certainly don't subscribe to that. You know, this is really one of the reasons we put together the Energy Outlook, and we review it and revise it every single year because it isn't used as a sort of a PR tool, although we do go out and talk about it. But it's really used to help us to look ahead and decide, you know, how do we want to run our business in the best interest of our shareholders. And you know, certainly we don't see that date out there, particularly since at the end of the day, you know, one of these renewable fuels is going to catch on and will be economic and will be a killer app in its own right. And put that together just with, you know, basic human ingenuity. You know, we see unbelievably large coal reserves around the world. Well, okay, you know, it gives off a lot of CO2 per unit burned. So if somebody can figure out a way, and I know they're doing research at the Prairie Research Institute to deal with carbon dioxide sequestration, well, you know, how many decades or centuries is that worth? And that's just coal. So, you know, we don't even think in those terms. It's really more along the lines of, you know, where do we need to be focusing our efforts, given that we are first and foremost an oil and natural gas company to meet the needs of our communities and our shareholders.
So you think particularly as far as transportation is concerned, that for the foreseeable future, we're going to be using vehicles powered pretty much as they're powered now, and that we're going to rely on a liquid fuel pretty much like we do now, but that are you really looking forward to the time when more and more of that, maybe not the majority of it, but more and more of that, it's not going to be pumped out of the ground. It's going to be produced in some other way, but it's going to yield something that we're going to, you know, you roll up to some kind of filling station in 50 years, you're still going to do that same thing. You're going to pull out the nozzle, you're going to open up your tank and pump some liquid thing into there, and then you're going to drive off. You think that it's still going to be like that?
I don't know. 50 years is a long time. You know, even with our energy outlook, we currently only go to 2030. But, you know, you have to think of the advantages of using this liquid fuel. There's a huge energy intensity there. It's a higher energy intensity, say, than ethanol. You can go further on a tank of gasoline than you can go on a tank of ethanol. As you say, the infrastructure is there, and it's you can fill your car in 5 minutes instead of recharge your batteries in 8 hours. So there's a convenience factor there certainly as well. The range of the vehicles, depending on what it is you drive, can be, you know, up to 500, 600 miles per tank full. So there's huge advantages, which are going to be tough to beat for any other competitive source. So, you know, no, I don't know what it's going to be like in 50 years, but I can tell you that, you know, just the facts of the physics and the chemistry are not going to change.
Yeah. So we're just about the point where we have to finish. Maybe we have a minute or so. So what sort of thought would you like to, idea would you like to leave with people?
Well, thanks. Appreciate that opportunity because I think, you know, all of us are, you know, subject to hearing the sound bite of the day, whatever it might be, to say, well, you know, if we do X, this will solve all our problems, or if we do Y, it'll solve all our problems, or we need to focus on something else. It really is. It's a tougher world than that. It really is all about increasing the supply of energy to meet the growth demands, primarily coming from parts of the world where people are coming up out of poverty. It's really about using energy a lot more efficiently, and it's really about managing the environmental impacts. And it's not a question of pick two. We need to be focusing on all three.
All right. Well, there we'll have to leave it. Our guest is Mike Loudon. He's a geophysicist. He works with the ExxonMobil company. He's visiting the campus here to speak. His visit sponsored by the Prairie Research Institute. That's the home of the state scientific surveys here on the U of I campus or Urbana-Champaign. Thanks very much for being here.
You're welcome. Thank you. So there's a convenience factor there certainly as well. The range of the vehicles, depending on what it is you drive, can be, you know, up to 500, 600 miles per tank full. So there's huge advantages, which are going to be tough to beat for any other competitive source. So, you know, no, I don't know what it's going to be like in 50 years, but I can tell you that, you know, just the facts of the physics and the chemistry are not going to change.
Yeah. So we're just about the point where we have to finish. Maybe we have a minute or so. So what sort of thought would you like to, idea would you like to leave with people?
Well, thanks. Appreciate that opportunity because I think, you know, all of us are, you know, subject to hearing the sound bite of the day, whatever it might be, to say, well, you know, if we do X, this will solve all our problems, or if we do Y, it'll solve all our problems, or we need to focus on something else. It really is. It's a tougher world than that. It really is all about increasing the supply of energy to meet the growth demands, primarily coming from parts of the world where people are coming up out of poverty. It's really about using energy a lot more efficiently, and it's really about managing the environmental impacts. And it's not a question of pick two. We need to be focusing on all three.
All right. Well, there we'll have to leave it. Our guest is Mike Loudon. He's a geophysicist. He works with the ExxonMobil company. He's visiting the campus here to speak. His visit sponsored by the Prairie Research Institute. That's the home of the state scientific surveys here on the U of I campus or Urbana-Champaign. Thanks very much for being here.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And you've been listening to an interview that we recorded here in our studios last week when Mike Loudon was visiting the campus. We were going to do that as a live program, but we were preempted by a presidential news conference. That's why we did it in this form.
Support comes from Meyer Drapery Services. Specializing in custom draperies since 1972, Meyer Drapery offers more than 1 million linear yards of drapery material in their two local wholesale warehouses and retail outlet at 330 North Neal in downtown Champaign. Installation and design services are also available.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music, breathing life into the history of our nation's musical past through exhibits, guided tours, and performances at the University of Illinois. More information is available and visits can be scheduled at 217-244-9309.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. I'm David Inge. We're midway through the program. We'll take a break as we usually do, then we'll have more of the program, and so we hope you'll stay tuned.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. We're at mid-session. Grain futures exploding to the upside one day in advance of what is supposed to be a very significant October USDA crop production and WASDE report. Grain futures rallying, bucking the trend in other commodities. Soybeans gaining for a second straight day on talk of fresh purchases by China, maybe 6 to 8 cargoes. As well as wheat gaining 2.9% and corn rising over 2% as investors are scoring up their positions ahead of tomorrow's reports. Let's go ahead and look at particulars, and it has been a very volatile day to the upside. The December wheat in Kansas City at 708.5, up 22.5, now up 22 and three quarters.